You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. This is another installment of Voices of the Middle East, and I'm Gudar Zaktadari, your host. The first part of the program, you were listening to Dr. Leila Mariati, who had a lecture here last Friday for Muslim Educational Trust in Portland, and talked about the struggle of American Muslims these days. Now I'm going to another part of the program. My guest tonight is Dr. Lisa Hajar. She's a professor at University of California, Santa Barbara, and an associate professor in Law and Society Program, and also the author of Curtain Conflict: The Israeli Military Court System in the West Bank and Gaza, published by University of California. And without further ado, I have Dr. Hajar online. Welcome to the program, Dr. Hajar.
Yes, hi.
Okay. Thanks for accepting the invitation. And as I was telling the audience, you have written a book on the Israeli military court system in the West Bank, and you have been speaking about the issues recently on the secret detention sites of this U.S. government in Europe and elsewhere.
Well, I've been writing generally about the issue of sort of the whole American torture scandal. I have an article that just is appearing today on The Nation, in The Nation magazine. It's online now, called An Army of Lawyers.
Okay, let me start with, would you give us a kind of a brief introduction to the cases that CIA, secret detention and interrogation in general, and the specific case of the people who are now known to be treated this way, like Khaled al-Masri and Mahmoud Habibi and Mohammed Ulad Salhi and also Saad Iqbal. What do you know about their cases and how they have been sort of kidnapped and, in a way, interrogated for a long period of time in unknown sites? And what do we know about those sites?
Okay, well, just to provide a little bit of background, you know, early on in the war on terror, when the United States started utilizing, you know, policy or practices that would constitute torture and ill treatment against people they were being, they were capturing, it immediately became obvious that this would put U.S. agents at risk if they were engaging in these practices in the United States or somewhere where U.S. courts would have jurisdiction. So that was one reason why Guantanamo was established. But even Guantanamo was a place where the people sent to Guantanamo were mainly people considered to be, if they, you know, they were assumed to be kind of small potatoes. None of the people that were captured who were assumed to be high-value targets were ever sent to Guantanamo, with the exception of Mohammed al-Qahtani. So those people were picked up either in Afghanistan or in other countries and mainly transferred into CIA custody. For so one form of interrogation was that conducted by the CIA itself. And so on that score, we have a number of issues happening. One thing, the CIA operated secret sites or sites within larger military bases in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and elsewhere, but that U.S. military personnel and certainly military laws were not considered applicable to the CIA. And so many people were brutally interrogated in these CIA detention sites. Many of the people in CIA custody, I mean, early on, again, in I think 2003, the Pentagon basically declared that people who were in CIA custody would not have access to, or the International Committee of the Red Cross would not have access to these people. So for all intents and purposes, beyond, you know, the CIA custodians themselves and, you know, other members of the Pentagon, people were being disappeared into CIA custody, you know, where the Red Cross would have no access to them and no one would really know their fate and whereabouts. The other thing that has happened, and I'll come back to the question of CIA custody in a moment, but some prisoners who were interrogated by the CIA and then not considered to be so crucial to ongoing investigations, but who were either had been extremely brutalized themselves or were considered maybe still significant, just not significant enough for the CIA, were then rendered over to other countries, you know, including countries with well-established records of torture, including Syria, Egypt, Jordan, and Morocco. So on that score, the CIA was then transferring some people out of its own custody into the custody of other governments. And we know that, for example, Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen who was picked up as he was transiting through Kennedy Airport in 2002, I believe, was sent by the CIA to Syria, where he underwent, you know, many months of brutal interrogation and then subsequently was released because it was clear that he actually had absolutely no connection to terrorism and so on. So he's, in fact, returned to Canada and is now suing Donald Rumsfeld and others for having ordered his rendition. But there's about 100, or at least it's estimated to be about 100 prisoners who are really these, you know, presumably, well, at least that they've been really disappeared in CIA custody. 30 of them, you know, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Abu Zubaydah and Ramzi bin Shabib and others, are considered to be quote-unquote high-value targets. There's about 30 of that category estimated by sort of people watching this. And another 70, it's completely unknown who what their identity is or what their significance is, if they have any connections to Al-Qaeda, or if so or not, what that would be. The CIA was operating essentially secret prisons, not only in countries where the U.S. military was operating, like Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in other countries. So, for example, Abu Zubaydah was the first high-level Al-Qaeda suspect to be captured, and he was initially located in a secret CIA facility in Thailand. But when news of that came out, the Thai government was embarrassed, and then the CIA subsequently located him elsewhere. What we've learned since November, when the Washington Post produced an article, which was really the one that's been, you know, kind of roiling the world lately, is that, you know, among the places where the CIA was operating some of these secret prisons included on the continent of Europe. Now, the problem, there are several problems. One is that, you know, it's in the continent of Europe, including in countries that are U.S. allies, perhaps unbeknownst at least to the general publics of those countries. But also problematic is the fact that Europe has a very strong and enforceable set of human rights laws. And so this created a whole set of problems for European governments, for the U.S. government, and for the CIA. When that story came out in early November, as reported by Dana Priest in the Washington Post, it immediately forced the CIA to scramble to get all of the secret detainees, whichever ones might be located on the European continent, out of Europe. And apparently the latest news is that they've been relocated to some secret site somewhere in North Africa, although to my knowledge, the location has not been identified yet.
As far as, I guess, international law and basically Universal Declaration of Human Rights, how these practices, I mean, obviously they are in violation of international human rights law, and in Europe specifically, you mentioned, it is in contradiction with the European Union code of practice. And
right.
Any country in Europe can be questioned for this kind of activity.
Mm-hmm.
But we hear that, for example, the Interior Minister of Germany, Otto Schily, was informed about this, but was asked not to say anything or not disclose it.
Right.
And I don't really understand why would a foreign ambassador go and meet with the interior minister instead of foreign minister in Germany,
mm-hmm.
and share this kind of information about Mr. Mastri's abduction. And then now, for example, Condi Rice, in her trip to Germany during the meeting with Angela Merkel, admits the erroneous activities of CIA. But in fact, I mean, these are violations, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, so one way of thinking about it, you know, and I think one way of explaining what's been going on from the European point of view, and also to understand the, you know, the contents of Condoleezza Rice's statements once she's been in Europe. One thing is that, I mean, as you know, it happens in this country and elsewhere, that some agencies of the government will operate, you know, in ways that are unbeknownst to other agencies of the government, especially those that are dealing with security operations, and certainly to the public. So we know, for example, that in you know, the Swedish government, you know, and Sweden has a very strong track record on human rights issues, but around the question, you know, in collaborating with the United States, you know, under the assumption that this is a shared mission to combat terrorism and catch, you know, the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks and other attacks, you know, members of the security services in Sweden helped the CIA initially to actually capture two people in Sweden. But then once they, you know, were still physically in Sweden, the CIA took custody of them in an airport, in a Swedish airport, and this, you know, the Swedish government officials saw what was going on, that these two men were, you know, sort of stripped naked, given, tranquilizing enemas, put in diapers, and put on a plane, and then sent off to Egypt, where it was subsequently revealed that they were tortured. And you know, even the security agents in Sweden were a bit alarmed at the time. But as that story broke, and other sectors of the government and the public learned about that, it was, you know, one could say on the one hand, well, quote, Sweden helped the United States in its extraordinary renditions. Indeed. But it was one sector of the Swedish government, and now there's been a crisis in Sweden. Same goes for the Berlusconi government in Italy, where the Berlusconi government, in fact, helped the CIA also kidnap people from Italy and move them elsewhere. And once that information became public, now you see the legal system, you know, the prosecutorial office in Italy now naming, or at least seeking to indict, 21 CIA agents who operated on Italian soil in violation of Italian and international laws. So while the Italian government, you know, or one sector of it, participated with the U.S. government in renditions, another sector is now fighting against it. Same goes for Spain. I mean, in the sense that at least it's been alleged that planes transporting prisoners around the world have landed in many countries, including in Spain, and now a sector of the Spanish government is seeking some kind of legal recourse for the fact that, you know, disappeared prisoners actually set down on Spanish soil, which gives Spain a kind of territorial claim to its law enforcement. So then what this means then, and what we're hearing Condoleezza Rice saying, she's trying to appeal to a certain kind of an argument, which is that, you know, all of these countries are menaced by terrorism. The need to combat terrorism is a collective action. She's more or less continuing on in the Bush policy line, which is that the law should be no obstacle. But she's essentially appealing to people to see security and the law as contradictory, and to prioritize security, and to indicate that there have been people in the various European governments who see the world the same way the Bush administration sees the world, even though there are other people in the government and much stronger laws in Europe that make this now an incredibly complicated issue diplomatically and a fluid issue legally.
And as far as, I guess, recourse, how we know that ACLU filed a lawsuit on behalf of Khaled al-Masri.
Yes.
And what base are they going to be able to follow this up, and whether it's not going to be thrown out of court because of administrative power, for example?
Well, one way of thinking about the prospect of prosecuting people involved in torture, and by involvement that includes, you know, since torture and other forms of abuse are illegal, you know, but then one has to think about, okay, so which laws apply to which people and how can you enforce those laws? So let me just mention one thing, that for U.S. members of the U.S. military, anyone who wears a U.S. uniform is subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which actually enshrines the Geneva Conventions. And the Geneva Conventions actually prohibit, regardless of the status of prisoners, those rules govern U.S. soldiers. And so many soldiers are now who've engaged in abusive practices are liable for prosecution. Not only the soldiers directly involved in abusing prisoners, but everybody up the chain of command in some ways could be subject to those laws. Now, the other thing for the CIA is that because they're not members of the military, but there are U.S. laws and certainly international laws that have universal, you know, that have extraterritorial jurisdiction. But to actually prosecute people, what we're seeing now in terms of the prosecution of people who've been responsible for torture, we're seeing well over 100 U.S. low-ranking soldiers have now been, you know, faced prosecution or administrative penalties for these abuses. But people up the chain of command, including Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and others, have not at all been subject to any kind of accountability for this. What happens is that other countries, including Germany, including Spain, the Scandinavian countries, have certain kinds of laws that make it possible to prosecute foreigners in the courts of these other countries if those foreigners are not prosecuted in their own country. So this is why the issue is still so fluid. For example, a case that was brought in Germany on behalf of some torture victims from Iraq and Afghanistan, naming Donald Rumsfeld, General Ricardo Sanchez, and others for abuses that took place in Iraq. Germany has a very strong law, but basically kicked the case out, at least for now, on the grounds that it's not, we don't yet know if the U.S. will prosecute its own. So there's this, you know, the vague sense of when will it be clear to foreign courts that the U.S. is unwilling to pursue accountability and enforcement of the law up the chain of command. So time becomes a factor, and you see, I mean, in the case of a former dictator of Chile, Augusto Pinochet, sometimes these cases, or Hassan Habré of Chad, these cases are pursued years after a person is out of office, but they never die because there's no statute of limitations for the prosecution of torture.
I guess I want to ask a question: whether the United States not signing into international court would make any difference?
No, in my opinion, no. I actually have. I'm critical of the International Criminal Court for the reason that it's very much subject to the dynamics of, you know, state power on the international system. So I think it makes it, it's much easier and more likely to prosecute people from smaller or weaker or, you know, rogue states than it is to prosecute someone in the International Criminal Court from a powerful country. The ICC, the ICC, were all the countries in the world to sign on to it, it would be a logical venue. However, the other alternative is the one that many people are now seeking, which is something called universal jurisdiction. And torture in particular, I mean, unlike almost any other crime, torture attaches universal jurisdiction, which means that it's always a crime everywhere, and therefore people, at least in principle, can be prosecuted for the crime of torture anywhere. And so this universal jurisdiction was the factor that was being used in the Pinochet case when Spain was seeking to indict Pinochet and transport him from England. It's also the grounds for bringing a case in Germany. It's the grounds for bringing a case in Italy now against the CIA agents and other things. The idea that torture is such a clear and prohibited crime that it must be prosecuted, and any, you know, legitimate court system can be a venue for the prosecution of torture.
With your knowledge about the systems around the world, I would like to ask whether you have been exposed to any similar practice in other countries. The picture is pretty much like a Hollywood movie, like folks coming in a black outfit with ski hoods and they grab somebody on the street and put them in the car and go and...
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, in fact, it's, you know, to some extent, it's reminiscent of a number of different kinds of contexts. And let me, I mean, for example, during the dirty wars in Latin America, it was, you know, the state agents of the various military regimes would when they would go around and pick up people or disappear them, you know, it was often indicated that some of these folks, you know, these security agents would be wearing hoods and black outfits or some, basically in ways that would make them unidentifiable. So that both they couldn't be identified and then their activities could subsequently be denied, you know, so that there would be no evidence left. So one can say you could see that certainly in the Latin American context during the dirty wars. As far as the actual interrogation practices go, you know, I mean, my particular expertise is on Israel-Palestine, and, you know, I mean, one can say that there's a, you know, there's a great number of ways in which Israeli practices have served, you know, for better and worse as a model for the United States government. So on the one hand, you know, Israeli interrogation practices vis-a-vis Palestinians were such are different than, say, interrogation and torture practices in a more, you know, sort of obvious dictatorship like Syria or, you know, Iraq under Saddam Hussein, where there was no need, you know, people just, I mean, security forces could just go wherever they wanted, pick up people and take them away. They didn't even need to articulate what they were doing in a legal framework or to even excuse themselves because, you know, the media was repressed and so on. Whereas in a country like Israel, where there's a, you know, a high level of expectation for at least the public to know and understand that the government is acting legitimately, the Israeli government, since, you know, really the 1980s, went to great lengths to explain its interrogation policies as legal. So even though these policies would, you know, many people would argue that they constitute torture, they were justified and sort of brought into the legal system on the grounds that claiming that they were not torture, but they were, quote, moderate physical pressure. You know, and then the purposes being served by these interrogation practices, as far as the Israeli government was concerned, that you have to be able to coercively interrogate Palestinians because of the threat of ticking bombs. Although the ticking bombs in those scenarios really were Palestinian nationalism was the main ticking bomb at the time, and since the 90s or the late 80s, it's really become sort of, in addition, Islamic, you know, violence and so on. But in that regard, I think that's a model for the U.S. in two ways. One, trying to argue that what is being done is somehow legal if you interpret the law in a certain way. And the second argument is that, you know, the tactics used themselves are ones that are, you know, for example, using less tactics that don't leave physical marks. So, for example, even the most, what we know of as the most sort of, you know, one that's a tactic that's gotten a lot of press, waterboarding, you know, to immerse someone's head in water to make that person believe that he or she is about to be drowned. You know, drowning doesn't leave any marks, and so one can waterboard somebody, scare them, you know, to presumably then, you know, fearing for their life, and then the presumption is that they would then start speaking, although if one is fearing for his or her life, the likelihood that what they're going to say is true becomes highly dubious. But so waterboarding is a tactic that, you know, is preferred because it doesn't leave marks. Or position abuse. Again, this is something that the Israelis used incredibly extensively. It's like tying prisoners in painful positions so that their own body begins to work against them. Their muscles cramp, you know, they go into incredible pain, or sleep deprivation. Things like these that can be done to break people. But then it becomes, you know, because interrogation occurs in secret sites, it then becomes the word of the prisoner versus words of the state, you know, or the words of the state. And, you know, without marks, it's difficult to prove allegations of torture.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hajar. I'm sorry we are getting to the end of the show, and I would like to invite you to another program maybe in the near future and discuss more issues. And thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
For accepting my invitation.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.